UK Wine Show, show number 96. Richard Smart on climate change. On this week's show,
Cabernet Sauvignon will not be so well suited to Bordeaux.
And in the news this week, new wine tasting dating service is launched, Thresher Group announces restructure, and Screwcap's best for keeping wine fresh.
G'day! Welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 96 for the 21st of March 2008, and Happy Easter! My name's Chris Scott, and this week we're talking with viticulturalist Richard Smart about climate change. Richard is a world-leading viticulturalist and named Wine International Personality of the Year for innovation, and is certainly an outspoken and straight to the point. When asked in an interview what his greatest personal achievement was, Richard said, seeing the viticultural landscape change by canopy management. But we're going to be talking to Richard about climate change and what his take is on it. But before we get into that, let's have the news with Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. If you're a single Londoner who likes wine and is looking for love, there's a new dating event service that introduces people while tasting wine. Wine Data will offer wine tastings for singles at top London bars, with equal numbers of men and women attending, and everyone going through dates lasting around 5 minutes while they taste wine. After the event, daters can log on to the website and complete an online matching form if they're interested in contacting a fellow dater again. The concept isn't entirely new, though. Founder Nicola Greaves began running wine dating events 3 years ago through the Wine and Spirit Education Trust, and grapevinesocial.com is already well established in London. But wine daters are pushing the premium nature of their events and promise a very tasteful experience at top quality venues. For more info, you can visit www.winedata.co.uk. Events cost £30 per person. Next up, high street drinks retailer Thresher Group is to develop three distinct retail brands and abandon 3-for-2 promotions on wine and champagne. The move is part of Thresher's restructuring program and will mean store closures as well as new sites, bringing the overall number of stores down from 1,620 to around 1,500. Under the new strategy, Wine Rack will target 35 to 55-year-olds, offering premium and fine wines starting at £5 to £10 a bottle. Thresher will target busy shoppers with wines at £4 to £6, and The Local will provide branded wines, beers and spirits to attract young mums and local residents. Each store will get a new look and layout, and there are also plans to launch online sales. And finally, Australian fine wine producer Liuwin is rebottling older vintages of its Chardonnay under Screwcap, having found that trial cases sealed this way stayed fresher and were far better preserved than bottles under cork. The internationally acclaimed winery has been releasing most of its wines under Screwcap in recent years, but 10 years ago, when most were sealed with cork, they put a few cases of different varieties under Screwcap. These wines have since been tested against those under cork in a blind tasting, and results showed that wine under Screwcaps were clearly much fresher and far better preserved. That's it for this week, but for more details on any of these stories, please visit our website 3050.co.uk. Back over to you, Chris.
Cheers, Jane. Well, the march of the Screwcap continues. I used to be all Screwcap, but over time I've tempered my applause for the Screwcap a bit. I still believe it's probably the best closure for wines in glass bottles that are to be drunk young, which is pretty much all the wines in the supermarkets or the corner dairies that most people buy. But there is a case for cork in some wines. I've been tasting a lot of wines under Diam closure last year and this year. Diam's a special type of closure where they grind the cork down into almost dust, and then they pass it through a process that involves really high pressure and heat and pretty much removes all the cork taint, or TCA. When they reform the cork, it's ready to be used and taint-free. There are also some environmental aspects of cork which need to be considered. I have an interview coming up with Carlos Jesus from Amarim on cork, which we discussed this. This isn't to say that I'm a big cork fan. Far from it. After all, green glass in the UK is a terrible waste and total environmentally unfriendly. where we haven't got a use for all that green glass that arrives here. And to that end, I actually have an interview lined up with Tony Charlie from Banrock Station on Tetra Pak. Banrock have been advocating Tetra Pak now for a while, so we're going to be talking to him about that. Perhaps the future is not which is better, plastic or cork or screw cap, but whether glass or perhaps Tetra Pak is a preferred solution, or maybe even PVC, like in the lemonade bottles. Speaking of the environment and wine, I went to Vintage Roots tasting a week or so ago. Vintage Roots are an organic importer, and we interviewed Lance Piggott from there back in show 18, so you can go back there if you want to listen to it. Now, while I was there, I found what must be one of the heaviest wine bottles ever. It weighed more empty than any other bottle full. This wine is by a company called Emiliana from Chile. They're an organic producer. What surprised me was, you sort of expect Napa wines to be environmentally unfriendly with big, heavy, overweight bottles, but not an organic producer, and it really surprised me. I certainly wouldn't list the wine, and we'll continue using one of their wines. We use Koyam from them, which is a very popular wine. It's normally in our top one or two or three wines on our top 30 wine list, but I certainly wouldn't take that wine from them. And listeners, if you live in the UK and you find wine that bottles that are particularly heavy, they are not environmentally friendly. The other tasting I went to this week was France Under One Roof, which was a great chance to try a good range of French wines. The most noticeably was actually a Viognier Chardonnay blend from Robert Joseph, the UK wine critic, who's teamed up with a winemaker and a designer to produce a range of wines under the branding Hugh, Kevin and Robert. I think Robert mentioned the wines back in the podcast I did with him back in show 76, but this was the first time I tried them. Unashamedly commercial, fruit-driven wines, the Chardonnay Viognier managed to keep ripe tropical flavours and marry it with a light touch of oak. I thought it was really good, and around £7 a bottle, not too bad going. The reason I turned up to the France Under One Roof wasn't to try the wines, it was actually because I was recording the latest Harpers podcast, which will be released on the Harpers website, harpers.co.uk, earlier next week. I'm going to release a 10-minute presentation by Tim Atkins. He's a leading UK wine critic, and we interviewed him as well a wee while ago, and on why he likes French wines. I'm going to release that in the middle of this week, probably, so do keep an eye out for it. This is also the last week for you to have your say in our monthly poll. The question, if you recall, is fair trade wine has been made in Chile, Argentina, and South Africa. If it was available alongside other wines, would you buy it? I've been having a look at the ratings, and it surprised me a lot about what people are saying. Do go to our website, ukwineshow.co.uk, and have your say. I also really enjoy your feedback, especially on what you liked, what you dislike, and any ideas for future shows. I'd love to know what you think of our new Spotlight segment. Last week we were talking about oak barrels, where they come from, and why oak is such a great medium for wine. This week we're going to be talking about how barrels are made and the different flavours that come from the different types of oak. So, let's have our spotlight on oak barrels. Making oak barrels is divided up into several steps. Cutting the staves, seasoning, toasting, and making the barrels. To start with, let's look at cutting the staves. As mentioned last week, French barrels are low in tolusis, which give water-retaining properties to barrels. It is for this reason that French oak can't be sawn into staves used to create the barrels, but needs to be split along the grain of the wood. American oak, which has much higher tolusis and can be sawn across the grain while retaining its watertight properties. This is one of the main drivers of price. Splitting is slow and requires expensive expertise, while cutting is cheaper and simpler. This makes American oak barrels cheaper. Next up is seasoning. Before barrel construction, the cut, split oak staves must be dried out and seasoned. It also allows some important chemical modifications to occur. Tannins in the oak are reduced, as are some of the bitter tasting compounds. At the same time, there's an increase in some of the aromatic compounds. Drying the staves in ovens is quicker and cheaper. However, the chemical changes do not occur. The consequence is that oak has fewer aromatic properties and more bitter components, ready to leach into the wine. Poorly seasoned oak leads to nasty wine. The next step, after oak barrels have been seasoned, is to toast the barrels. Manufacturing the barrel involves heating the barrels over a fire so they can be bent and shaped. The charring that occurs on the inside is referred to as toasting. The level of toasting that the barrel receives determines the toasty flavours imparted in the wine. When used appropriately, the toasting flavours can add a significant beneficial effect to the wine's flavour. The final step, barrel making, which ties in with toasting is that they occur at the same point. The barrel maker is called a cooper and has specialist skills often taught as an apprentice. Oak staves are shaped and fitted together over heat to soften the wood to bend it. And the final barrel and how it influences the wine is determined by the wood selection, age of the trees, which part of the trunk is used, seasoning, and the amount of toasting. Once the barrel is completed and the wine is added to the barrel, the flavours from the oak barrel can get into the wine. This is quite technical, but do bear with me, and it gives you an idea of the different flavours you can get from the wines. So the first one is lactones. Lactones are the most important oak-derived flavour in wine and are known as oak lactones. On their own, oak lactones smell like coconuts, but in wine they can smell oaky too. The two main types are known as cis and trans isomers of B-methyl octalactone. If you're a chemistry person, you'll know what I mean by cis and trans isomers, but if you're not, don't worry about it. The seasoning affects the ratio of cis to trans oak lactones, and toasting reduces the overall lactone levels. Trans has a coconut aroma, and cis has coconut and earthy herbaceous characters. American oak is higher in lactone concentrations, so you can expect wines that have been in American oak to perhaps smell a bit more like coconut. The next major flavour imparted in the wine is vanillin, the component behind vanilla, and is present in significant quantities in oak. If fermented in contact with the oak, the yeast used in fermentation reduces the vanillin concentration. Thus, barrel fermented wines smell less vanilla and oaky, even though they may have been in the oak barrel for longer. Levels of vanillin increase with mild toasting, but can decrease with heavy toasting. The next flavour is guaiacol. Guaiacol has a smoky aroma and is also described as spicy. It is formed by the degradation of the wood component lignin during toasting and therefore increases at higher toasting levels. Another smell you might expect is the clove-like smell from the chemical eugenol. It increases with seasoning and toasting, so if you've got a heavily toasted wine, look for clove in there. Another component you might want to keep an eye out for is furfural 5-methylfurfural. And has a sweet butterscotch and caramel aromas, and possibly a hint of almond. It's produced by heat-induced degradation of sugars and carbohydrates during toasting, so a toasted barrel may have some butterscotch, caramel aromas, and maybe some almonds. The last chemical to keep an eye out for is lignotannins. These tannins are absorbed by the wine from the wood and are known as lignotannins. They modify the structure of the wine and increase the colour of the wine. They have an astringent taste as well. The concentration does decrease as heavy toasting levels. Now, many of these compounds occur at levels below their individual detection threshold in wine. However, they can have a synergistic effect on the flavour and aroma of the wine. For example, the perception threshold of oak lactones is reported to be 50 times lower in the presence of vanillin. In addition, the combination of more than one of these can produce complex flavours or aroma sensations. Whether or not any of these flavours will be positive depends upon the context of the wine. It is a complicated business. I hope that sort of explains some of the chemicals that you get. Also, you know, whether the toasting will influence it, the seasoning, etc. And it'll give you an idea of the sort of flavours to look for. Also, gives you an idea of how the winemakers made the wine or the barrels they've chosen as well. Now, originally, I was going to finish this series off today, but I've decided to finish it off next week as there's quite a bit to take on, particularly today. Obviously, you can get the full transcript of the notes by going to ukwineshow.co.uk and selecting oak barrels on the left-hand side. Oak barrel making and its use is an important part of wine production. But, according to Richard Smart, all the real work's been done in the vineyard beforehand. Richard believes the truth behind great wines is not the winemaker, but rather the unsung heroes, viticulturalists. Well, he would say that being a viticulturalist himself, but Richard is a well-respected viticulturalist, and we finish up this week's series on climate change by talking to Richard about his views on climate change and grapes. Let's have a listen to what he has to say. Hi, I'm with Richard Smart. How do you describe yourself? Do you see yourself as a viticulturalist or...
Yeah, viticulturist is a fair description.
Okay, we're actually here in Barcelona with the Climate Change Conference, and you've just done a fantastic presentation on effects of climate change on vines.
Yeah.
Just some of the stuff that came up that I thought was quite interesting. You started out, you described state terrorism possibly as polluting the atmosphere, and it's quite a political thing. That's quite a strong statement.
I think terrorism of the future will be seen to be polluting the Earth's atmosphere. I think political divisions over state boundaries are going to get, well, more fuzzy when we think about we all have the atmosphere in common.
Yeah.
And countries that continue to pollute with no regard for other countries that feel the impact are going to be viewed internationally in a poor light. And I think the word terrorism applies, because what is a terrorist? A terrorist is someone who does damage to others without regard of how much damage or where it is.
Probably fits. You did sort of scathe the industry a wee bit for our packaging. You sort of talked about half the weight and half the volume is taken up in packaging.
Yeah, well, if you think of a case of wine, about half the weight and half the volume is in the packaging. And given that wine is a commodity that's traded so much, I think it's about time the sector did review its packaging. Soft drink people did it 20 years ago. Beer people are starting to do it now. Why not wine?
No, for sure. Although, you look at some of the packaging options around, like PET or Tetra Pak, and they're not really for long shelf life.
But they don't have to be, you know. Let's face it, most wine is bought for consumption that evening. Maybe your listeners are people who have extensive cellars and put wine down, but the bulk of wine in the world isn't drunk that way.
If you go to that situation where maybe only the wines for long cellaring go into glass and everybody moves to some sort of other format, won't that almost create a perception of a two-tier wine, so that the non-glass wines may be seen as inferior? And that, is that maybe the driver for staying with glass?
It could be. But, you know, what's wrong with that? More expensive wine costs you more money, so there's already a two-tier system, isn't there?
Fair enough. Okay, getting on to some of the topics you covered in the presentation. You've done some work on looking at different climates and how the climates are going to change. You know, in a broad brush, what do you think are the big changes that global warming is going to occur for wine?
Well, let me try and encapsulate it for you in a few sentences. The wine world as we know it now is the product of a couple of hundred years or more of stable temperatures. Therefore, we have wine regions scattered around the world, and those in the old world in particular are discrete regions that have developed reputations for excellence of one or a few varieties. Now, that's fine. What happens if the climate changes? Let's take a French example. Bordeaux, Greater Bordeaux, has developed a reputation for Cabernet Sauvignon. The Bordelais would argue it's the best Cabernet Sauvignon in the world. Well, that's another issue. That's their position. Now, what happens when the climate changes? Cabernet Sauvignon will not be so well suited to Bordeaux. Now we've got a problem. And it could be said that if you go back 30 years ago, the best vintages, or the vintages that made the best wine, were those that were warmer and drier. And over the last 20 or so years, we've had a succession of warm vintages. The wines have been good. What happens in the next 20 years when it gets even warmer?
Yeah, for sure.
Are the Bordelais going to say, oh, we've had to rethink what's a good Cabernet? We actually believe what's a good Cabernet is the one like they're now growing in the Languedoc. Do you think that's likely?
I think they'll try.
Oh, they'll obviously try, but, you know, maybe within 30 years I'll be starting to argue the merits of their Grenache or their Carignan or something.
So do you think that the regions like Bordeaux or, you know, Australia, they're going to have to change the grape varieties that they're growing?
The quick answer is yes. We either change the regions or we change the varieties. If we're in a present cool region like Germany or Alsace, that's not much of a problem. We'll grow the varieties as suited to present warmer regions. And the warm regions like Bordeaux will be okay because they'll be able to grow the varieties that are now grown in the present hot regions. However, when we consider the present hot regions, and the south of France isn't particularly hot by world standard, but here in Spain there's some very hot regions, in Australia, in South Africa, in California, in Chile. What happens to them? They have nowhere to go. If you look at what they do produce in hotter regions now, they produce table grapes or grapes for drying. They don't produce wine grapes. So we have a problem with our existing hot regions.
You mentioned that the US will actually start to contract as a wine-producing region. Why don't they just move north?
What, and go into Canada?
Well, no, you've got...
They'll be no longer US.
Well, you've got Washington State, which is still quite a cool region. Why don't they just move further up the coast?
Well, they can. And in fact, the guy who'll talk tomorrow will talk about that. And they can certainly go nearer the coast too, because the current in California is very cold. They're lucky in that regard. Not all places in the world have a cold current near their coast. So they will go north and they'll go closer to the coast, but the area that's suitable for grape production will still contract. And we know this in Australia, it'll contract southwards as well.
Yep, and maybe open up Tassie a bit more?
Yeah, although Tassie's not very big, but yeah, sure, it will.
It's not just the movement of vines that are going to be moving, there's pests as well. What sort of disease pressures are going to happen as things change?
Well, that's probably the first sign we'll have of climate change. Of course, climate change has been documented as already affecting the world's wine industry for the last 20 or so years. People don't realise it and they don't talk about it because these changes are subtle and they're small, but they are going on. However, insect distribution can be, depending on the species, quite temperature sensitive, and it's probably one of the first signs that we'll see is that insect pests will move, and, you know, that, as I say, it'll be the first sign we'll see. For example, now in southern Germany, they have a problem with a serious vine disease called bois noir, which is spread by an insect, and that disease is moving northwards into southern Germany because the insect is moving northwards as it warms up.
You also mentioned in your speech the multicoloured Asian lady beetle.
Yeah.
You said it when it gets squished or gets upset, it produces some...
Methoxypyrazines. They're actually the compounds that make Sauvignon Blanc
that's
smell nice.
Yeah.
But that's a good methoxypyrazine in Sauvignon Blanc. There's some really horrible ones. And they're in the multicoloured Asian lady beetle. Interestingly, it's been found in the UK, and if you look up on the web, you'll find that it's spreading rapidly in the UK. I haven't heard of it yet being in a vineyard, but it's a horrible little pest. Because it gets in the bunches, and when you pick the bunches, it doesn't like being disturbed, so it puts out this stink. And it's such a powerful stink, it can contaminate a lot of bunches, a lot of wine. And also, it gets in your house in the winter.
Oh, really? What's it smell of?
any analogy that comes to mind is not the sort of thing I want to say on a respectable wine show like yours. Let me just say nothing pleasant.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. One of the effects of climate change is obviously increased alcohol across the board and maybe a loss of acidity in a lot of the wines. Is there anything that the grape growers can do to mitigate some of those effects?
Yeah, sure, they can pick their grapes earlier.
Yep.
That's all they've got to do. This, you do get higher alcohol in hot regions because the flavours take longer to develop, but this current fad of high alcohol wines needs to be knocked on the head very quickly, and all we've got to do is go and harvest the grapes earlier.
Won't you get different flavour ripeness and tannins and all that?
That's the mythology of it.
Is it?
Yeah, because it's mythology.
I've always been told that's what happens, so what's...
Yeah, but who do you talk to? But you probably talk to oenologists or winemakers, and they're the people who perpetuate this myth. Probably you believe in this myth that old vines make better wines too, but again, that's another myth. No, these are just words that people toss around. You probably know that the Californians have this concept of hang time. The longer they leave the grapes, the better they'll be.
Or riper.
Yeah, and the net result is the wines are more alcoholic. The flavours don't change measurably. And we just end up with higher alcohol wines. And I know, in fact, the origin of this term, hang time, because I was present when it was first used. Actually, I should say physiological ripeness. And it was coined by an oenologist in California, and her marketing department picked it up. And it's become now part of the mythology.
When I've spoken to winemakers and they taste grapes before picking, and they say that the flavour changes. You're laughing a lot.
Well, firstly, you should challenge the word winemakers. It's an abomination of the English language. People don't make wine, yeast do. So if you're going to use the term winemaker, you can call me a grape maker.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, I'm not a grape maker, I'm a viticulturist. People who make wine are oenologists. All they do is to regulate a biological process. If you get a bunch of table grapes and leave it in a bowl on your table, you'll end up with wine after a couple of weeks. Right?
Not
it's
the
a
best
natural
stuff.
Process, isn't it? Because it won't be much good.
I did try to grow grapes make wine when I was a kid, about 10, and all I ended up with was mould.
Yeah, sure, you do. I mean, that's why we have technology of winemaking. It's called enology.
Yep.
Right? We have technology of grape growing. It's called viticulture. But this term winemaker suggests that these people actually make the wine, and it's led to a class of egotist. These people believe that they've got a magical touch. In fact, most wine is made in a vineyard. I, as a viticulturist, can do more to influence wine quality than most oenologists. Trust me. So if anyone's going to be called a winemaker, it should be me, not these people who press buttons on crushers. But that's very important to understand this because, you see, the winemakers like to think that they go out in the vineyard and taste the grapes and they can determine the time of harvest. And they'll say, and they sort of chew the grapes a bit, scratch their bum and look up in the air and they say, doesn't quite have the flavour yet. Well, I tell you what, we'll pick it next Tuesday. And that's what they do. Yep. And I've seen these people operate. And the sad fact of the matter is, for most grape varieties, they cannot taste the flavours that are present in wine.
What about Sauvignon Blanc? That's supposed to be reasonable.
Sauvignon Blanc's one of them.
But you can.
But you hear, yes, it is, because your saliva breaks down the flavour precursor. But for most varieties, you know, Chardonnay, they can't taste Chardonnay flavour. They're just kidding themselves, and it's just that they want to be in control. They imagine the most important decision in viticulture is the time of harvest. That's a demonstrable nonsense. And if they want to be out in the vineyard and influence wine quality, and I encourage them, they're 2 months too late. The important decisions have already been made.
Okay.
But so anyway, let me not go on about enologists. We'll be here all day.
That's you, wee bugbear of yours.
No, it's just that the buggers get more highly paid than I do. I think it's unfair. They also get more credit than I do. It's grossly unfair.
We'll come back to this later on, but we'll crack on with climate change first for a bit. One of the things you talked about in your presentation was, yeah, we talk about average temperatures going up by 1 degree, 2 degrees, but you also talked about the standard deviation of the temperature becoming more variable. So you're going to land up with a bigger range of temperatures along with that increased average. Does that mean the temperatures could be cooler as well sometimes?
Yeah, sure, it does. I mean, the predictions by the climate scientists are that as well as the average getting higher for temperature, they'll be more variable. And it means we will have more days of extreme heat, more days of cold, I suppose, but it's the extreme heat that does the damage from a wine quality point of view.
There seems to be a magic number that you used in your presentation of 35 degrees. You talked about
the mean July temperature, I mentioned 25, which is the average temperature of July in the Northern Hemisphere for wine-growing regions. We tend not to grow grapes at a higher temperature than that. Now, basically what happens is that the vines don't create as much flavour compound at high temperatures as they do at cooler temperatures. There are some varieties that are adapted to it, but not too many. But my point is we've got plenty of time to breed vines that will be capable of producing good wine at high temperatures. And I'll give us an example, the excellent breeding work they've been doing in Germany and other places for the last 50 years, where they've bred grapes for cool regions, quite the opposite. But they've done a fantastic job. You can now, for example, grow vines commercially in Denmark. I mean, it's amazing. And you can do that because of these vines that have been bred in Germany. So I'm sure that we'll be able to do it for varieties well suited to hot regions.
Okay. In terms of the big winners and losers with global warming, what countries do you think are going to be going well? Which ones are going to lose out?
Well, the ones that will lose out essentially are Northern Hemisphere countries, and that's because in the south there'll be less global warming because we have more oceans. And so the countries that will do best are Chile in particular, but also Argentina, New Zealand, Tasmania, where I live, which is an island off the south coast of Australia, parts of Australia. South Africa's a bit far north. So they're really the ones that are going to see less change.
They're the ones that normally seem to have a lot of water around them or altitude.
Well, they've got a lot of water around them.
I was thinking Argentina, that was the odd man out.
Argentina, but you see, it goes very far south, Argentina. And in this southern hemisphere, one of the ways, well, you've got two ways to get it cooler. You either go further south towards the pole or you go up.
Yep.
And in the instance of Chile, they can also go nearer the coast because they've got a very cold ocean current there.
It's the Humboldt Current, isn't it? Okay, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much for your time. Well, I hope you managed to stay with us over the last 4 weeks and have found these shows useful. Over the next 2 months, I'm releasing my own notes on climate change and wine in the spotlight. Some of the information covered in the conference in Barcelona was not covered in the podcasts, but I hope to get that additional information together and up on the website. As my notes go up, keep an eye out for them in our spotlight section under climate change on the left-hand side. I've also got all the interviews with our four people on climate change in that page. Next week, we're going to be talking about something completely different. We're going to be talking with Susie Atkins. Susie is a wine writer for Delicious Magazine and the Sunday Telegraph. We find out about her, how she got into the wine trade, and what the future is looking like for Susie. So until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Jane Scott, recorded and edited by Chris Scott, and the news is researched by Sandra Clement. To listen to other shows, visit www.ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.